Shock and sadness as fashion designer Kate Spade commits suicide. Good Wednesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead in the shock and sadness over Kate Spade's death, we're going to take a closer look at why suicide rates are on the rise, particularly among women. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, from the Beatles to Bullet Bob Hayes, historian Scott Grant on how the pivotal civil rights summer of 1964 changed Northeast Florida forever. Plus, don't miss the in-studio performance from the Florida Chamber Music Project. That's coming up, too. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, this hour, tragic news about famed designer Kate Spade, the woman who rocked the fashion world with her elegant bags and other accessories, committed suicide Tuesday in her Park Avenue apartment in New York. Now, Spade had apparently battled depression and possibly bipolar disorder for years. She was just 55 years old. While her death comes as a shock, it also highlights a worrisome trend in the United States, women dying by suicide at an increased rate. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, since 1999, suicide rates in this country have increased about 25% overall, and the number of women dying by suicide is also rising, particularly for white females. There's an 80% spike in suicide rates, 3 to 4 times higher than for women in other racial and ethnic groups. What's driving this? Well, here with her thoughts on the death of Kate Spade and also how we can highlight efforts to prevent suicide right here in our area, we welcome Wendy Hughes. She's CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida. Good morning.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us. And here's our question to callers. We're talking about suicide prevention right now on the show in the wake of the news about designer Kate Spade. Do you have loved ones that are struggling? Do you need help yourself? Get on the phone and call us right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. We're already getting your comments as well on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. So Wendy Hughes, Kate Spade's death has thrown into sharp relief the news that suicide rates among women are on the rise. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, I think when we all heard the news about Kate Spade, it was a reminder that you never really know what's going on in someone's life. No. This is a woman that had millions of dollars, was a global icon. Her brand was loved by women everywhere. She lived on Park Avenue, for goodness sake. And she seemed to have it all. And yet, behind closed doors, she was really struggling. To me, that just was a reminder that that's the case for so many people.
Well, I think the main thing to consider is that happiness is not about things.
Yes.
And mental wellness is about your connections and relationships with individuals, not with about wealth or success in your career or with attainment of items.
Right.
And, you know, you may look at someone and think, such as Kate Spade, what a successful person, but you don't know what someone's life is like behind those closed doors.
Exactly.
And you don't know what she was struggling with in her personal relationships. And I think the connections that we make and those struggles that we have connecting with individuals, that is the true that's the true challenge, and mm-hmm. that's what's truly driving our challenges in the mental health world.
And this is a woman who, according to relatives, had mental illness, had struggled with depression. Her sister has told media outlets that she had urged her to go into treatment for bipolar disorder, and she had almost gotten her to commit to treatment a few times, but she just couldn't get her in the door. And that's a common story, isn't it?
I mean, it's the social stigma of that. And you take someone like Kate Spade, who is in the media and, you know, high profile, and you tag on to that the social stigma of mental health treatment. And you're not going to get them to want to go forth and seek that treatment. We as a society have to accept mental health treatment as a commonplace occurrence, no different than cardiac treatment.
Right. Removing stigma is so important because so many people suffer, as apparently she did, because they're afraid to have it become
taboo.
Known that they need help. And we'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937 as we talk about this and also efforts to prevent suicides in this country. 28 women in particular die by suicide every day in the United States. There's been a 128% increase in death by suicide in women age 45 to 64 since the 90s. What's driving this, do you think?
I think it's just the lack of social connection. That is one of the biggest drivers of this. You know, we've got to find a way to have that connectedness. I often theorize, and you know, it's me not as a psychologist, because I'm not, but you know, we're a society of eyes. And we're all striving to climb that ladder, and we're about me and we're about I, but we have to connect together, and we have to create those fabrics of a social support system. And that is what is missing. Those natural supports that we all need to develop in order to manage our daily stresses and cope with all of the things that are thrown our way, you know, because without that, you know, whether we have mental illness or just a normal, you know, crisis in our lives, you know, these kind of things happen, because suicide is not always a product of mental illness. Suicide can be the product of a crisis, of a major illness or pain or something to that effect. You know, we need that natural support system in our lives. And I think culturally speaking, we don't develop that in this country as well as we should.
Well, right now we're going to go to some calls and connect everyone. Try to forge some connections. If you're hurting out there, or you know someone who is, or you just have thoughts about this, right now we're talking with Wendy Hughes, CEO of Mental Health America of Northeast Florida. And in a moment, we'll talk about their efforts to get help in this community to those who need it. Give us a call with your thoughts right now, 549-2937. Mario is on the West Side. Hi, Mario. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I love this topic. I'm glad that we're talking about it. Unfortunately, as a licensed mental health counselor, I do have a little bit more, contact with people that suffer this issue, and I'm glad that it's coming out. I'm sorry that Kate Spade passed. I just wanted to make a comment. We no longer use the word committed in mental health. We try to, the word has been, suicide has been decriminalized for several years now. So now we either say completed or died by suicide, because we have so much of a tie with like religion and you know, with it being having been a crime, you know, many years ago. We don't want to look at it as a sin. We don't want to look at it as a crime, but we want to just let people know that, yes, it's highly stigmatized, but it is a way that people, unfortunately, cope. And, it's a long-term solution to a short-term problem. You know, I tell my clients, and it's not a healthy one. But thanks very much for having me. And
Thank you, Mario. Thanks for pointing that out. That's important. The language that we use about this, I guess, is important to note.
Yeah.
Not say committed.
Right.
I appreciate that. And you know, it's interesting to look at these statistics, too. By 2-1, women are more likely to commit suicide in recent decades in this country. and they face increased sensitivity in part due to changes, fluctuations in hormones or thyroid function as they move into middle age. Kate Spade was 55. There could be a complex interplay of factors that go into this.
Right. I mean, as you go through any kind of change in life, you know, these kind of things are impacted by genetics, biology, environment, crisis. There can be a host of issues that impact any of these kind of situations.
Apparently, Kate Spade's husband wanted a divorce, and that was part of the issue as well. We're still learning about this.
Right. The situational aspects will probably never be fully known. I think that, you know, supporting, obviously, you know, the family and giving that support in this kind of time. But I think from a public perspective, understanding the warning signs of suicide are very important, so that knowing the resources and so that anyone going through a similar situation can get help and know where to get help.
And signs like what? For example, apparently Kate Spade had been self-medicating more with alcohol. That's just one sign. There are so many things friends and loved ones should be aware of.
Right. And there are some, you know, basic warning signs that, you know, are pretty well published, and they call it is PATH warm. Is kind of the little acronym you can use, and it's is there an ideation of suicide, substance use?
An ideation of suicide means saying you're going to do
thinking about it. PATH, the acronym PATH, is someone purposelessness. So are they, you know, do they feel as if they have no purpose?
What does PATH stand for?
Purposelessness, anxiety, trapped, hopelessness.
Okay. Let's go to a few more calls. Greg is on the north side. Hi, Greg.
Hi. How are you doing, Melissa?
Okay, thanks.
Great. And your guests have answered a number of the questions that I did have, but I'm a police officer in Jacksonville. I've worked a number of suicides over my 23 years. And most of them have been men. So now I see, according to your statistics, women are going up quite a bit. So I have a question as to what can we as law enforcement do while we are going out to various calls? What should we be looking for, signs or symptoms in women that may be thinking about attempting suicide?
Yeah, thanks, Greg. And I'm so glad you mentioned that because, yeah, in the past, what we have been given an understand is that men were more likely to follow through with suicide than women, but that's changing. So what should police officers and other professionals be looking out for women?
Well, I think it is these signs of, you know, hopelessness, withdrawal, anger, recklessness, mood changes, you know, those are the early warning signs. Obviously, the immediate warning signs are anyone that is actually talking about suicide or making a plan for suicide, who are seeking out ways to harm themselves or making a plan to kill themselves, or saying or threatening to kill themselves, or making comments such as, I wish I were dead, I should never have been born, I'm going to kill myself. Anytime anyone says anything like that, you know, never take it as a joke.
Take it very seriously.
Take it very seriously. Call 911.
And how do you get someone, for example, Kate Spade's sister claims she was trying to get her into treatment but couldn't convince her to go. If you're a family member of someone like that, how do you get help to them if they are reluctant to be helped?
Well, you know, that is where you really, in this instance, where there is threat of harm to the self or to another person, That's where 911 should be.
Call 911. Don't be afraid to do that.
Don't be afraid to do that.
Okay.
Because a life is at stake.
Lana is along I-95 South. Lana, hello.
Hi. So I just wanted to make a comment that whenever someone famous dies by suicide and it's all over the news, I always see on Facebook people saying, you know, like, oh, please talk to me, reach out to me, I'm here for you. And as someone who suffers from mental illness where suicidal thoughts happen more often than I, you know, than a normal person, it's just, it's frustrating to see that because we don't necessarily need you to post a Facebook status that says you're going to listen to us. What we need is a society that doesn't stigmatize mental illness. We need a society that accepts it.
That's right. You're right. You're very right. You know, the fact that this person was famous shouldn't matter.
Right. And so what are simple ways all of us can help to destigmatize mental illness?
I think we have to be able to talk about it and talk about it in a way that is no different from any other illness or condition. We have to make mental illness be no different than any other health condition. Cardiovascular disease, hypothyroidism, diabetes. It needs to be a disease that is talked about as easy with any doctor or medical professional or anything else because it's real. And it is a disease and a disorder of the brain. And it has to be talked about in a way that we can get that message out there that people can talk openly and freely about it and not be judged.
And Kathy emails the show, treatment can also be expensive or not covered, difficult to get. We need to talk about that too, because depression is a serious illness. Accessing care can be hard for many Floridians.
It is. And I think that, you know, we've got to start that conversation because there have to be more resources and availability of those resources put into mental health treatment in this nation.
And so finally, for people listening to you right now and they need help, where are some local resources that you recommend they turn to besides your own organization, Mental Health America of Northeast Florida?
Right. I think if anyone out there is, you know, contemplating suicide or needs to just talk to someone, has concerns, my first recommendation is if there's anyone critically, call 911. But the 1-800-273-TALK is the National Suicide Hotline. That is a 24/7, 365-day-a-year phone line. That is the best number to call. There is also the Florida Suicide Coalition, Suicide Prevention Coalition website. Has a lot of valuable information out there, which is great for individuals and family members that want to educate themselves. NAMI Jacksonville also has a wonderful website that has a lot of wonderful information, support group information, and all of these websites have provider referral information for our website has information that can help people refer to therapists and providers within the community as well. So we want to get you connected if you need assistance. There are phone numbers on all the websites. Mm-hmm. It's our website is mhajax.org. We have a provider referral system. We have some free mental health screening tools online. We can get you connected.
So don't hesitate to connect. There is help out there for those that need it. And Wendy Hughes, CEO of Mental Health America, Northeast Florida, thanks so much for joining us with this potentially life-saving information for everyone out there. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead later. Local historian Scott Grant on the pivotal civil rights summer of 1964, how everyone from the Beatles to Bullet Bob Hayes changed the First Coast. But up next, we're going to tango right here in studio with the Florida Chamber Music Project. Don't miss their performance. Back in a moment.
Oh, Ansbacher Education presents its annual legal update on June 13th in Jacksonville and June 14th in St. Augustine. This seminar will cover new laws affecting condominium and homeowner associations. Register at Eventbrite. More information, ansbachereducation.com.
For generations, the faith community was the social safety net that helped the less fortunate in our country.
That began to change during the Great Depression, when the economic downturn greatly affected how religious communities were able to help those in need. So what is the role of faith communities in our social safety net? I'm Nancy Bronner.
And I'm Kyle Reese. Join us for Faith Matters, our quarterly program that looks at today's issues through the lens of faith. Thursday at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
What happens when an elite squad of cops uses their badges as weapons?
I'm tired of being locked in.
And you write a song about it.
That's one thing we cannot do. We can't make a song about the police that's going to bring us trouble.
Put the cuffs on my mother, put the cuffs on my father, then put the cuffs on my brother.
A story of crooked cops terrorizing a city. On the next Reveal.
Saturday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the Florida Chamber Music Project has been wowing local audiences for 5 years now, and they're celebrating their fifth anniversary this Saturday night with a masquerade tango gala out at the Pontevedra Concert Hall. I spoke about it with artistic director Susan Pardue, and we also got a special treat, a live in-studio performance. Take a listen. Welcome, Florida Chamber Music Project.
Hello,
hello, Melissa.
Hey, good to see you. Susan Pardue, your artistic director with this group. Tell us a little bit about the Florida Chamber Music Project and also this big gala that you have coming up.
Well, we have just celebrated our fifth season, and we have a gala coming up at the Pontevedra Concert Hall Saturday, June 9th from 7 to 10. It's a tango masquerade. We'll have tango dancing, tango music, a tango dance lesson, and we're going to have masks designed and painted by Susanna Schunke and an art exhibition of her works.
Sounds pretty romantic and exciting. So the tango, you think of this genre of music as being, you know, pretty sexy and intense. Tell me a little bit about the tango theme for this event and the music you're going to be performing.
Well, we're going to be performing a lot of tangos, and it's just music that's fun to play. It's a nice diversion for us. It's not something we play every day.
What are you going to be performing for us right now?
We're going to play a tango called El Choclo.
Here they are, the Florida Chamber Music Project.
Thank you.
Was incredible. The Florida Chamber Music Project. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Wasn't that amazing? Get your tickets now for the Tango Masquerade featuring the Florida Chamber Music Project Saturday night, June 9th at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. Much more still to come in a moment. Historian Scott A. Grant on how the summer of 1964 reshaped the South and America. That's next.
So he moves in with me, and, you know, my parents are thrilled. Their recently PhD-conferred daughter, you know, I have a PhD in theoretical physics from MIT, is living with an illegal immigrant who can't spell words like non-viable.
Join us for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, local historian Scott A. Grant has made a name for himself as he works to educate the public about little-known historical facts that have shaped this region's history, and they're fascinating. As just one example, Grant has given dozens of talks around the area on the 1942 Nazi U-boat attack on Jacksonville Beach during World War II. I bet you didn't know about that. And now Scott is starting a campaign to present the pivotal Civil Rights Summer of 1964, highlighting all of the dramatic events that happened that year, not just around the country, but here in town. And did you know that everyone from the Beatles to Olympic champion Bullet Bob Hayes changed this area forever that summer? There's so much to learn, and we're pleased to welcome Scott A. Grant to Studio 5. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. I'm really thrilled to be here.
We're thrilled to have you. You know, you made quite a splash, no pun intended, with your talks about the Nazi U-boat attack on the beach during World War II. And so now you've moved on to another critical era, the civil rights era. In 1964, the world was actually focused on Jacksonville and St. Augustine as demonstrations and protests were roiling America. So you're giving talks about this. Take us back to that time and what happened here that summer.
Well, one of the things that happens is that many of the most iconic figures of the second half of the 20th century come to St. Augustine and Jacksonville over a 6-7 month period. And as you mentioned, the Beatles, but Martin Luther King was here. He was arrested in St. Augustine. spent a week in jail. Bullet Bob Hayes wins the gold medal that summer in the Tokyo Olympics. He sets a world record in the 100-meter dash.
Mm-hmm. And when he came back to Jacksonville after winning all of these Olympic gold medals, the Florida Times Union didn't want to put his photo on the front page of the newspaper.
They didn't want to cover the parade at all. And the parade included Florida A&M, Texas A&M, Matthew W. Gilbert High School, predominantly African-American institutions. And the Times Union had no interest in covering it whatsoever.
In fact, they had a separate newspaper only for African-Americans at that time.
The Star Edition.
Yeah.
I think they characterized it as news of interest to the colored community.
Right. You know, the late Jessie Lynn Kerr, who reported for the newspaper for many years before she died, she appeared on this program and she told us the story of how she helped to integrate, really, literally integrate coverage of the Florida Times Union, because she insisted that Bob Hayes and the parade in his honor and photo and story be on the front page of the main newspaper. And so Bob Hayes broke the color barrier for the newspaper of record that summer in this city.
Exactly. And she's a hero for doing that. I think she goes into the editor's office and she says, I don't care if he's black, white, brown, yellow, or purple with pink polka dots. There are no other two-time Olympic gold medalists coming home to Jacksonville today.
Right. So Bob Hayes happens. The Beatles come to the Gator Bowl and they're told it's segregated. And the Beatles say, not for us. Right.
Correct. John Lennon says he would sooner give up his appearance money. Ultimately, the Beatles issue a press statement and they say, unless whites and Negroes are allowed to sit together, we will not come. That was on September 5th. The city relented. And on September 11th, we have the first integrated event in Gator Bowl history. But the day before, Hurricane Dora hits.
Right. And it was the first time this area had ever gotten a direct hit from a hurricane. Massive flooding in St. Augustine, where the civil rights demonstrations were happening, where Martin Luther King was marching. People saw that as a sign, didn't they?
Yeah, many people thought it was the wrath of God on both sides. The floodwaters ran hip deep through the old slave market in St. Augustine. And people thought that, you know, God was punishing one side or the other, depending on which side you were on.
Wow. Now, there's so much that happened within this tight little window of time, which is why you're giving talks about it. It's just so significant. Lyndon Johnson came to town in the midst of all this.
Well, he comes a couple times, but sequentially, Hurricane Dora hits around midnight on September the 10th. LBJ comes the morning of September 11th to survey the damage, have his picture taken. He flies out. A couple hours later, the Beatles land to give this concert. And they go to the George Washington Hotel. They do a press conference. And then they go to the Gator Bowl. They play 12 songs in 35 minutes. The winds are howling so badly that they need to nail Ringo Starr's drum kit to the stage.
That's kind of funny to think about. Serious times, but that's an interesting image, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, a lot of the people, there were 23,000 people there that night. There were more tickets sold than 23,000, but that's all that can make it because of the storm. Most of them will tell you that between the howling of the winds and the screaming of the girls, that you couldn't hear the show at all.
Couldn't hear the show. Now, that was in the fall, but a few months before that, as you mentioned, Dr. King was arrested for attempting to integrate the Monson Motor Lodge in St. Augustine. The owner of that hotel, Jimmy Brock, became infamous because there was this photo that flashed worldwide of young kids jumping in the swimming pool there, both black and white, and Brock poured muriatic acid in the pool as a way to force the children of color out of the pool. That photo, isn't it right that, Scott, that broke the logjam in Congress over passage of the Civil Rights Act?
Yes, that's absolutely true. The Senate was filibustering the Civil Rights Act. They were led by Barry Goldwater out of Arizona, who was LBJ's opponent that summer for president. And the very next day, LBJ, who was known for being quite persuasive, was able to stop the filibuster, and the Civil Rights Act passed. Now, it doesn't get signed into law for several weeks because LBJ wants to wait for Martin Luther King to get out of jail so he can come to the White House and witness the signing of the Civil Rights Act.
Later that year, Dr. King would be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. The police chief in St. Augustine called it a joke because he saw King as just stirring up a bunch of trouble.
That's absolutely true. And Virgil Stewart, who was the chief of police at that time, was not alone. A lot of people saw King as a troublemaker that summer.
So as we look into your research back in that pivotal summer, so much happened in this area that had an effect nationally on these issues, and not enough people realize that, I think, which is why you're doing these presentations, correct?
That is absolutely correct. The events that occur here at the Monson Motor Inn and in St. Augustine are as significant as any events in Montgomery, Selma, Birmingham during the civil rights. And we don't want to remember it because it's somewhat embarrassing, but this changed the world. Mm-hmm. Specifically the events at the Monson Motor Inn, that picture runs worldwide, and it causes hysteria. Now, the idea that someone would pour acid into a pool to keep black and white kids from swimming was horrific to the North and much of the rest of the world.
Yeah. Now, as you work to raise awareness about the civil rights legacy in this area, what are your thoughts about the discussion on the Jacksonville City Council as they look at how to continue a civil rights task force that would figure out a way to more prominently feature this area's civil rights history, maybe even create a museum so that more people can know this history?
I mean, I think we absolutely have to do that. We have to embrace this history. This is a pivotal moment, not just for Jacksonville, but for the entire country. What happens here changes the world, changes the United States. There would not have been a Civil Rights Act, at least not when it happened, had it not been for the events in St. Augustine.
What made you decide to go down this path of really becoming this area's most interesting, not most interesting, there are lots of historians, I don't want to denigrate other ones, but the one that's really working on educating the public about specific events and eras in this area? What prompted this?
Well, I've always had an interest in local history, but I think that these were two stories, the 1942 submarine story and the 1964 civil rights story, that really have not been told. And there's a lot of people who are anxious to see this story told. And I'm one of them, obviously, but it's a story that wasn't told, and I thought it was a story that had to be told.
Now, you're a finance guy, but
correct,
you employed your skills in a new way, doing historical research. How did you go about compiling all this research?
Well, I used a lot of firsthand sources, newspapers, magazines. For the 64 speech, there's a couple great pieces in the New York Times, Atlantic, and obviously the local press. There's more video. Actually, one of our favorite videos from this period is a 1965 Florida Highway Patrol training video. And they shot a lot of it in St. Augustine that summer. And the voiceover is all about, you know, teaching the police how to deal with crowds.
And what do they say in the video?
One well-trained police dog is worth 10 to 12 officers in crowd control.
Wow. That's a little ominous, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Well, you know, talk about ominous. The leader of the segregationist was a guy named Hoss Manusi, and he's president of an organization called the Ancient City Gun Club, which also sounds pretty ominous to me.
And what does he do?
He's pretty much leads the, again, he's the leader of the segregationists in St. Augustine, particularly early on. Those folks gather nightly at the slave market in what we now call Plaza de la Constitucion, and they hold rallies. There's a KKK attorney from Atlanta named J.B. Stoner and a preacher from California named Connie Lynch. And Connie preaches every night on segregation.
Right. You know, now you mentioned that there's been this effort in this area to almost downplay or deny this history. To this day, people down in St. Augustine will tell you, well, that really wasn't a slave market. When it very clearly was.
Well, it clearly was used. Slaves were sold there. It was an all-purpose marketplace. For what it's worth, there's a bronze plaque on that pavilion that to this day, identifies it as the slave market.
Right. Now, we're getting tweets about your presentation that you're giving about the summer of 64. Stephanie tweets the show, could you give us some reading recommendations for fifth graders on Florida and the civil rights movement? I think this speaks to why you're doing this, Scott, because kids are not being taught this history in our local school system. Not all of it.
The very first time I gave the speech, and several years ago, a woman in the audience came up to me afterwards. She was African-American, and she said, thank you. I was a teacher in the St. Augustine school system for 35 years, and we were never allowed to tell this story.
Never allowed to?
That's what she said.
Wow.
And so, again, I mean, this is a story that needs to be told. It's not, it's embarrassing in some ways, but it's not, it's a good story. We changed the world right here in the First Coast.
Yeah, it's something to embrace. And as the talk continues about a civil rights museum for Jacksonville, joining the National Civil Rights Trail of historical markers, and then there are efforts as well for a monument to James Weldon Johnson in the La Villa area of Jacksonville. You're doing what you're doing, belatedly maybe, but there seems to be a lot of movement on this lately.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think, we have this big new generation of kids, millennials, and I think they were not taught history during school or in school generally. They've embraced history as they've gotten older, and this topic appeals to their sense of social justice.
Now, this is cool because not only are you talking about this with me, you're going to be giving presentations about the civil rights summer of 64. You're going to be giving an upcoming talk out at the Beaches. It's called a boardwalk talk. What's going to be happening?
Well, the Beaches Museum, which is run by Christine Hoffman, puts on an event every month or so that they call a boardwalk talk. This will actually be in the chapel, which I think fits my style. And hopefully we'll get a good turnout. When we did the presentation about a year and a half ago on the submarine, there were 300 people showed up. So we're hoping for a good turnout at the Beaches Museum for the 1964 presentation.
And then there'll be more to come after that, I'm sure.
Yeah. We've got more scheduled. And typically once we start doing them, people ask for them. And it becomes a little side project that occupies all my time.
It's taken over your life.
the submarine speech took over my life. I mean, I gave that speech 85 times in 14 months.
And I'm sure there'll be demand for this one. So
I think so.
Keep talking, Scott.
Thank you.
And thanks for being on the radio with us.
No, thanks for having me. This is a dream come true for us.
Aw, well, he's historian Scott A. Grant. Go see his boardwalk talk on the summer of 64. It's coming up Thursday, June 21st, 6 o'clock at the Beaches Museum Chapel. The summer of 64, how the Beatles and the world's fastest man, Bullet Bob Hayes, changed the First Coast forever. Sounds pretty interesting. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me. It was wonderful.
And we'll be back in a moment with Suzanne Hudson-Smith of Players by the Sea. That's next.
In a data economy, which is, to be honest, the entire economy, getting the data is everything.
If certain competitors that compete in new ways don't have access on the same terms as all other brokers in the market, that can really hurt their ability to compete.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Who gets the real estate data and why? That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
When climate gentrification causes climate evictions.
They've knocked down the projects before, moved them somewhere else, never moved them back.
Climate change pushes developers onto higher ground, forcing residents out. I'm Tanzina Vega, broadcasting from Miami, and that's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Clint Watts worked for the U.S. Army and the FBI in counterintelligence, but says he's done some of his best work as a private citizen on social media with a home computer and credit cards. He's tracked jihadists and Russian actors meddling in American politics, and he testified to Congress on how to strengthen American democracy. His new book is Messing with the Enemy. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Odds are that some of the news you've been reading recently was written by a computer. Artificial intelligence is creating thousands of articles in newsrooms around the world, stories designed to have no spin and very little snark. Can we rely on robots to get it right? Next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, it's a new shining star at Players by the Sea. Suzanne Hudson-Smith is the new executive director at the theater company Near the Ocean, and she joins us now with more about Players by the Sea's next 50 years, because I think they're celebrating 50 years of theater in town. Hey, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. We are. We're about to start our 53rd season, actually, in September.
Oh, fantastic. Now, you come to Players by the Sea from another theater, the Florida Theater.
I do.
And so, as you take the reins of this organization, tell us a little bit about what you're planning.
I have a large theater background, studied and performed, and so I kind of get all the management and the roles of acting on stage. And this is a culmination for me. We're looking at really getting the community theater back into the community and getting the community in. It's my main goal, whether it's fundraising or it's getting people to come in and see the shows. The Players by the Sea has a strong, strong history of great support. And we want to keep the creativity going, but we want to use the space. There's a beautiful gallery that's there, and I want to activate that more. Mm-hmm. We use it right now for the shows, but there's many times that in between those shows, we might be able to open up our facility to the community and have them see a little bit more art and make sure that we can definitely continue educating.
I didn't realize that Players by the Sea has had an uninterrupted history of performances at the beaches. Sometimes they'd have to borrow or rent other performance spaces, but they've never stopped.
Never.
And that, to me, is a testament to just the strength of the arts community in this area.
It's amazing, not just at the beaches, but all over. I have never been in a community in which there have been so many supporters of the arts, and they're supporting all the arts. So every single theater in town has their own niche. They do their own work. They exceed expectations always. Mm-hmm. And the community continues to follow and support and uphold the work that we've been doing.
Now, with all of that said, you've got a new production on stage.
You do.
It's called A Seat at the Table. What's it about?
It's a part of our New Voices, which is a playwright development series for the area. And Jim Webb comes in as the playwright for this. And it's gone through the process of being worked on as a young script, being developed over the course of time, working with other dramaturgs and coming in and working on the piece with him. It's on stage right now. And definitely you can expect the unexpected, as we say, at Players by the Sea. Because this piece really, it's a strong piece. I was there, of course, opening night, and folks coming out of it were like, that's powerful. And that's what we want to do there. We want to make people laugh, cry, talk, but it's the conversation afterwards and how those pieces touch them that makes a difference. So come see Seat at the Table. It'll be there through June 10th.
Excellent. And playersbythesea.org for tickets.
Yes.
And then I'm sure more provocative shows in your head that you want to put on stage later on.
Oh, there's a list running.
What's at the top of your list?
I'm not, there's a list, but we've already got a season set for next year. So when we start looking at In the Heights, which is coming up in the summer, you know.
Oh, Lin-Manuel Miranda's play.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now you want to come out and see that one. So they've had a great list and they're using that list right now. So I'm there in this first season to just connect that community and get people in to see these great shows.
Absolutely. And yeah, as people go see Hamilton downtown, they can come out to the beach and see the performance or the show that he did before Hamilton.
Absolutely.
In the Heights.
Absolutely. And that's a nice bit of history. I think not a lot of people have connected those two together, but we've got it at Players by the Sea.
What I love about Players is you really put on performances that but you can't see anywhere else in this community. You did Angels in America.
Yes.
You've done a number of provocative works that really are not being staged anywhere else in the region. So it's really just an amazing theatrical resource.
It really is. And the talent that's on the stage and the group that I'm working with, from production staff, to the creative team that gets out there and does this work every night, to an incredibly engaged board of directors who have kept this theater going for over 50 years. Not all the board of directors currently have been there for 50 years, but it's the spirit. But it's the spirit.
I don't think anyone could handle that. Oh my gosh. But kudos to you, Suzanne. And again, go to playersbythesea.org. Get your tickets now for A Seat at the Table and check out their slate of shows through next year. More announcements coming soon. Let's hope we don't get battered by strong storms at the beaches this season and people can keep crossing the ditch to see great live theater out at the beach.
Please do. And I invite everyone listening, come out on June 19th. Have a chance to come in to see the Players by the Sea, the theater itself, but we're having a little open reception and open house, so I get a chance to meet as many people as I can.
Oh, very nice. Suzanne Hudson-Smith, kudos. She's the new executive director at Players by the Sea. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Again, playersbythesea.org to get your tickets. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers this morning. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Shevchuk. And make sure to subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes and Stitcher. 1A is up next as former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder takes on gerrymandering. Learn more about that in a moment. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We will be off tomorrow for the quarterly program Faith Matters. You can listen to that tomorrow at 9 a.m. And be sure to join us at 9 a.m. Friday for our Friday Media Roundtable. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, just keep listening for the Electro Lounge, everybody. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.